Thank you, Lars. Thanks very much. And the original title was like 3 lines long, so maybe it's just as well that you cut it down to the chase. So given the fact that we had so many discussions during our program about what the evidence was from various sets of data that we've been looking at, it seemed appropriate and right to pick up from where Gianfranco left off a few weeks back with his excellent introduction to the aim and purpose and the overall theme of our program, to pick up from there and talk a little bit more about the methodological issues and the kind of problems that we've been facing in trying to find our matter signals in a variety of channels. And so I would like to start off by looking back to what Rutherford allegedly said over 100 years ago. He was quoted as saying that if you need statistics, then you did the wrong experiment. Well, I'm going to take the view in my talk that today in the 21st century physics and astrophysics and astroparticle physics, if you don't need statistics, then you've done the wrong experiment. Because the thing is, in reality, all of the data sets that we now are looking at and are of interest for the cutting edge questions of our age are highly complex, highly difficult to interpret. And we do need advanced physical tools to do the best job, or to do any job at all. So that's something that we take very seriously at Imperial. We have recently founded a new center called the Imperial Center for Inference and Cosmology, or the ICIC, whose mission is precisely to advance the use and adoption of astrostatistics as a tool to answer complicated theoretical questions using data sets in astrophysics, cosmology, astroparticle physics. So why do we need statistics at all? Well, let me just start off with 5 reasons why we actually need this as an important tool for science. First of all, as I said, today we have complex data sets and models. So much so that chi-squared by I is simply not enough. We need a toolbox that's appropriate for the kind of complex theoretical questions we ask of increasingly large and complicated to describe data sets. Secondly, an objection that I often get, especially from people who are more theoretically inclined, is just wait until you get 5 sigma. Just wait until you get 5 sigma. And then you don't need statistics. Then you sit in the data by eye, and there's no need to do anything fancy to the data. But actually, the reality of the matter is that most of the cutting-edge science we're all interested in doing doesn't lie at 5 sigma or beyond. It lies in the 2-3 sigma regime, because when these clear-cut like that, it's no longer interesting, and you move on to the next question that's further down the road, where you can just about tease out the signal from the background or not. And so finding those interesting signals from new physics is a moving target, and the goalpost is constantly moving, and if you want to be ahead of the crowd, you want to use sophisticated methods to tease out those signals from the data. Third objection is systematics. I'm not gonna believe anything statistical because there are systematics anyhow, and especially in astrophysical probes of dark matter, you can always argue your way out by invoking some unknown systematic, and that's true. But at the same time, if you have a better approach to modeling your system, then you can include the physics of systematical effects in a better, more complete way, and thereby hopefully get around some of those constraints, or at least model them better and evaluate whether or not they're important for your problem. Sometimes there won't be better data. By that I mean, in certain cases, we can't just wait and measure things better because we've done the best job we can already. Think of the CMB and the large-scale anomalies, or the large-scale structures in the universe. Once we've seen those objects, we've seen those large scales, we don't get on the sample. We don't get a fresh sample of those unless you plan to stick around for a very long time, that is. And then 5, data are expensive. And so it's an expensive procedure to gather them, to build expensive, complicated instruments to get them. And so it's only fair that we do the best we can in terms of analyzing them and making the most out of them. So in reality, what I want to talk about is sort of the statistical, or if you want, methodological paradigm by which we should be doing science, or we do science, specifically dark matter science in this context, namely the fact that we have a theory here, or if you prefer, a model, or if you prefer, which you can parameterize different sets of models for apps, and each one comes with sets of parameters that we want to learn. Those theories, they typically make predictions for observable phenomena in the universe. And we have some observations. Now, of course, the name of the game is to go back from the data. We want to go back and evaluate what those data mean in terms of parameters of the models we're interested in, but about the models as well. So we have different explanations, say dark matter candidates, and we want to evaluate in a quantitative way which ones of those explanations is best in some sense. So that is the task of inference. And because it goes back from the data to a theory, it is used to be called sometimes inverse probability as well. Now, the point I want to make here is simply that science and physics is made of these two pillars, really, theory and observations, as we all know. And statistics, really, or rather inference, is what connects the two in a unified way. So it's fundamental. It's the third leg on which science stands. But then the question is, which kind of statistics do we need? And we're all familiar with classical statistics that we get introduced to in undergraduate courses. But actually, most of the time today, I want to spend this talk talking about sort of the new emerging paradigm of Bayesian statistics, namely the idea that probabilities have not just to do with frequencies, which is a perfectly valid view, the classical view of probability, but they can be broadened in a way to make them more useful and more applicable to real-world examples. So here's a kind of a classical example, coin tossing, where I have a simple, a perfectly fair-looking coin, and we want to predict the probability of it being landing tails, let's say. And if it looks perfectly fair, then you might think that the probability is 1/2. Of course, now I do the experiment, I toss the coin, I look at the outcome, and what is the probability of it landing 1/2 now?
1 or 0.
Well, 1 or 0 for me, but we could argue it's still 1/2 for you because you don't have the knowledge that I have, namely the fact that he's tails right now. And so this example shows the probability of this particular, in this particular case, depends on the state of knowledge of the person asking the question. Or you can ask questions such as, what is the probability that the London Underground system has got more than 400 stations? And of course, you know, again, this is a yes or no question, but it's a perfectly well-defined question to ask, what is the probability of actually that statement, depending on your state of knowledge. If you happen to be in London, your confidence would be higher. You know, you've never heard about London or about the tube system, you might not know at all, so your probability distribution might be much better. And so there are questions that you can ask of the data in a meaningful way that do not fall within the remit of classical frequentist probability theory, but are perfectly valid questions. And such questions we can ask of the universe as well, especially on a large scale where you have just a few samples. And so in that context, it's useful to look at probability in more way, namely in a Bayesian way. And so historically, we have these two branches, the classical frequentist view of probability and Bayesian view of probability, more about which in a second. The Bayesian way of looking at things, perhaps a more physical way, is Bayesian, in fact. Started with Thomas Bayes, living in the 18th century. He published a pamphlet in 1663. Posthumously, after his death, this pamphlet was published by his friend, Richard Pryor. And actually, this year marks the 250th anniversary of the publication of an essay in the Doctrine of Chances, and so we're going to do some celebrations about that. And so Thomas Bayes wrote down the original Bayes theorem, which wasn't very much about inference at all. It was just a simple way of looking at a simple gaming problem. And actually, I think the argument Bayes doesn't really deserve the credit as founding father of Bayesian statistics. This credit could really be even Laplace, who later on in 1774 independently rediscovered Bayes theorem and actually applied it to a number of interesting astronomical examples. He applied it to problems in population estimation, in the census, and so on and so forth. He very much made use of what is now known as Bayes theorem in the modern sense. Laplace really deserves credit, or should deserve the credit, of actually being the first implementing Bayesian view of probability theory in practice. But the tide turned in the 20th century when the classical view of probability actually took hold by the work of the
great statistical institutions, because not all statisticians, but great contributors to essentially formalizing statistics as we now teach it in the school system, Fisher, Neyman, and Pearson, and others. Then we had established the classical theory of proprietary statistics, whereby we're interested in working random variables, hypotheses do not have probabilities attached to them, it's the data that come with from repetition of probabilities attached to them.
So
it's the proprietary view of probabilities.
So classic and frequentist are synonyms for you?
Well, not yet. I mean, I'm not being careful enough in distinguishing between them, but I will use an interchange of the other technically there.
Okay.
So this is really what we teach at our undergraduates. And there is an interesting twist of history because in the Second World War, Turing working on decrypting the Enigma machine, can be argued that he used Bayesian methods, what you can call them, like he used Bayesian methods to update probabilities as new information came in from spies about how to decrypt the Enigma machine. And so all this work, which had been done during World War II, was effectively top secret, and so was never publicized. So this work that arguably led to the decrypting of the Enigma code by the Germans and therefore shortening the war was never actually credited. Turing never got credit for it. And lots of work after that, which went on during the Cold War, also was done using laser methods, searching for submarines lost in the Atlantic, or determining probabilities of various events, for example, events of a nuclear catastrophe and so on, was done using a Bayesian framework, but was never actually published because it was kept under wraps. In the 60s, for example, Packy and his team famously predicted the outcome of the 1960 election where Kennedy won by a clean margin, and they did so using Bayesian methods. And this kind of things have been evolving ever since. And famously in 2012, the 2012 election, the 538 blog by Nathan Silver predicted all the 50 states, within the swing states, correctly using Bayesian methods for the first time. In 1983, just giving a flavor for things that have been going on, in 1983, NASA predicted, using whatever methods, or estimated that the probability of a catastrophic failure of the shuttle launches was 100,000. The private contractor using laser method predicted that the probability of a rocket booster failure was 135. In 1986, STS-51, the rocket booster Challenger exploded, and it was the 25th launch. So not bad as an estimation, unfortunately, for the Challenger people. But the point I want to make is that the real takeoff of Bayesian method came in the 80s, and later maybe the 90s, when computers became available. And why? Because computers, as we'll see, provided us with a workforce of Bayesian method in the Markov chain Monte Carlo methods. And so what was before the niche method now became useful and employable by everybody by using computerized ways of exploring those theories. Really, the revolution, this revolution started 20 years ago or so, and if you plot, in our field now, if you plot the function of time, let's say, from 1980 to 2010, you plot the log of the number of papers from the archive divided by the number of papers in 1980, you will see that the number of papers from the archive doubles in a constant for about 5 years, which means that the effort of reading the archive doubles every 5 years. Actually, if you plot a number of Bayesian papers that use Bayesian method, it's a much steeper trend. It doubles every 2.5 years.
This is the number per time?
Again?
Or the integrated number?
That's the number per year. And so if you continue this trend in the future, by 2042, all papers on the archive will be Bayesian. So this is a key difference then. On this side, classical statistics says that hypotheses do not have a probability statement attached to them. Random variables are attached to the data, parameters are fixed or unknown. There's no meaningful way by which we can say that a hypothesis or parameter set of the sort of probability. While the Bayesian approach is different, in this approach we say that probability statements are degree of belief or degree of information, and we can attach, we want to attach these kind of statements to hypotheses, to models, to theories, to parameter value. So reliance is a neat way of encompassing this difference. As this way of saying that for practice, they or the cost of physics, they approach problems with impeccable logic and give out answers that are of no interest to anyone, while Bayesians, they answer the question everybody wants to answer, but with completely unreliable assumptions. So, which side you want. So, well, what is this Bayesian framework then? At heart, this is a trivial consequence of the laws of probability, the fact that we have two propositions, A and B, P of A and B is the joint probability for the two of them. Then we can write this, the probability of P and B can be written as the probability of A given B, the conditional probability times P of B. And vice versa, of course, we can also do the other way around. So that's P of B given A times P of A. So that's basically Bayes' theorem, which is a trivial, almost trivial statement. And then the conditional probability for A given B can be written as a conditional for B given A, divided by P of A times P of A, and so on, divided by P of B. There's not much here. That's totally not controversial. It follows from the laws of probability. It's actually interesting that the result known as Cox theorem states that Bayes' theorem is the unique consequence, the unique generalization of Boolean algebra in the presence of uncertainty under a set of three fairly reasonable axioms. So there is actually quite a lot of interest in looking at Bayes' theorem from the point of view of logic in this case, of reasoning under uncertainty. So this provides a unique way of updating our Boolean beliefs from the prior to the posterior, as we shall see later. So that's a trivial statement that becomes interesting when you replacing for A the parameters, let's say, of the theory we're interested in evaluating parameters or the hypothesis. And for B, computing the data. And then we get following expression, and just like it for the record. So just in terms of nomenclature, everything here is called a posterior probability for theta, posterior because it's conditional on observed data, so it's a posteriori, means simply after we've seen the data. This one here is the probability of the data given theta, and usually we look at this as a function of theta for fixed t. That's a likely function. This thing here is a PDF, is a probability solution function, is a probability for theta unconditionally, or conditional on everything else you know about your problem but the data that you've actually observed. We call this prior. That's where the whole controversy stems from. That quantity down here, it's just a normalization constant. If you're interested in using this for parameter estimation, it's going to be interesting to us later on when we want to do hypothesis testing. It's called a model likelihood or evidence. So just a pedantic note, which is, remember from undergrad courses that the likelihood function is not a PDF for theta. The likelihood function is a PDF, a probability distribution function for the data given theta. And we can look at it as a function of theta, then becomes a function, but it's not a PDF. What this thing here is properly normalized. The evidence is just the integral of the likelihood as a prior over theta. So that thing here is a PDF, and therefore can be interpreted as such. It's really a posterior distribution, a probability distribution function on the value of theta. Well, something that the likelihood function is not. So that is, generically speaking, that is the quantity that we are interested in whenever we do science, whenever we ask questions of data about parameters, theories, models, and so on. So now there are three levels. It's useful to divide there is an inference in three levels. Namely, at the first stage, we want to do inference on the model's parameters. Let's say we fit the model and theory, and this theory comes with a number of free parameters. We assume it to be correct. It's our model. I thought of this, therefore it must be correct, of course. it comes with a set of parameters. And those parameters here, they have to come with the prior. We cannot even start thinking about things in a basic way unless we have a prior to begin with. So I'm going to write this explicitly now conditional on the fact that I'm assuming that this theory is correct. And then we can get a posterior from Bayes' theorem. That's then inference on the parameters, what we learn about the parameters, assuming the theory is correct. At the second level, though, we want to do model selection, model comparison. Namely, we realize, well, actually, there are different theories around, and we want to know which one is best in some sense. M1, M2, and so on. What we're interested in finding now is the ratio of the plausibility of those theories in the light of the data. So what we call the posterior odds, namely probability for, say, Mi, given the data, divided by the probability of Mj, given the data. That's the subject of model comparison, something that I'm going to address again. And then three, perhaps, once you realize that that's perhaps hit and miss in terms of physics. I mean, at this level here, you might want to do model averaging, namely, given that we might not know which one of the theories we're entertaining is the correct one, and there are several competing theories that are equally plausible in the light of data, you might want to evaluate constraints on the parameters after having averaged over the possibilities for which theory is correct without having to make a hard cut choice. That's something I'm not going to talk about. This is perhaps more useful in other contexts. But this can be useful for design optimization of future experiments. For example, if I want to build an experiment to get more stringent constraints on dark energy, let's say, but I don't want to put all my money on one specific dark energy model being correct.
The left-hand side is
a
PDF?
Here?
Yeah.
Yes. Properly normalized. So this value, sum over j of p of theta. And j, given the theta. And then, let's say, p of theta. Nj, P, P, Nj. So this makes it clear that model averaging merges the two levels. So that's the posterior for the parameters given, assuming the model is true, which gets weighted by the probability of the model is true given the data. And yes, that is a PDF. Okay, so I want to talk about these two levels, what we can do at this level and at this level specifically. So this for this level here is okay in that, you know, if we have a prior, we start from prior. We have to start from somewhere, right? So if we start from prior, that's somewhat diffuse. By diffuse, let's be careful what that means, because that would be my less specific. But in principle, what you do, you start from a prior, which is diffuse, whatever that means, meaning that it reflects the fact that you don't really know much about the parameters of your model, say. But if you start from somewhere, so then you get some data, you have a likelihood function, you go true, you produce a posterior distribution for theta given this data, so now this posterior distribution is better. It's more sharp in P, hopefully, if you learn something from the data. Just a 1D sketch to make this clear. Theta here, we start from some prior. That's our scale, diffuse. Other question? The likelihood function is more sharp in P, then you multiply this by that, you normalize the posterior is roughly similar to that likelihood. That's if the prior is not equal, if the prior is diffuse. And then what happens is now, next time around, now you use the previous posterior from the previous inference stage as your new prior. Next time you go out and get new data, now you take your previous posterior as your new prior, then you look at this, you get new data, so on and so forth, and you can show that this converges to a distribution that's independent of the prior, in the large, in the limit of the likelihood is sufficiently informative, and therefore, in principle, it becomes objective. So it doesn't really matter where you started from, as long as your likelihood is informative enough. And of course, the thing is in the words informative enough. I'm not sure you have any examples where we really aren't there yet.
Does this always converge to the same likelihood function as the frequentist approach would give?
No, it depends on the prior, right?
It's diffuse.
If it's diffuse, of course, you can always make up examples where, for example, you have the prime where you cut it off sharply at a certain point, and you know, if the prime is zero, it's a provisional prime space, you're never going to get there, doesn't matter how.
But let's say there's a non-zero value at the correct answer.
No, that's not always true. There are cases where you can get answers that are convergent in that sense here, but do not converge to the maximum likelihood estimate. And those are typical cases where the prior actually contains physical information. And that's my next point. Diffuse prior is okay, but usually what you want to do, or if you can, you want to actually give this prior all the information about the physics of the problem that you can. So if you have parameters that you don't have to be positive, for example, you want to enforce positiveness in the prior by cutting it at zero, for example.
Let me ask you a question which may reflect the knowledge I have on this. If I measure it something that has a value, let's say the mass of the Higgs is 125 GeV, both approaches, the classic and the Bayesian, should give me at the end the same result. Is that always true, or there are cases where one of the two approaches may give me the wrong answer?
Yes, it's not always true. There are cases, there's one called the Neyman-Scott problem. Which involves a number of measurements of the type on top. For example, you have n sources. You want to measure the flux from those sources, and you got as many calibration sources and calibration parameters as you have data sets. So in principle, it's a problem with it's the same number of parameters as the number of data points you have. You can solve this problem with a maximum likelihood method. You can solve this problem with the Bayesian method. And if you do, what you find is that asymptotically for the number of data points going to infinity, you find that the maximum likelihood solution is consistently biased away as many signals as you like from the truth. And the Bayesian is not. So it's not always true, especially in cases. It's true, this trivial example, just a cartoon, but there are cases where you have prior information that might be neglected in the maximum likelihood approach, where it never converges to the true value. And it's also not true in the small sample limit, where all the asymptotic results of the maximum likelihood estimators that we commonly use are typically not valid or bad approximations, in which case also you might get bad answers from maximum likelihood approaches, right? So take an on-off problem again, where you have a source, you have a sideband measurements, let's say, and then in the small count limit, it might be that your signal plus background number fluctuates below your background estimation, in which case maximum likelihood estimator gives you a negative value for the source flux. That's obviously wrong, right? Because you know the flux value has to be positive, so it's appropriately give up a limit, as it should. So, no, it's not generically true. And there are cases in which you can demonstrate which one of the approaches is better. For other cases, I'll show you in a minute, where it's harder to actually decide which of the approaches is best by any sensible criterion, and so it's probably best to look at both of them.
There are also cases where the Bayesian approach gives you some kind of something which doesn't really make sense. For example, if we look at the Planck parameter paper, they only cite an upper limit for a possible magnetic field, but they nevertheless give a best fit for the spectral index. So how can you have a spectral index of a source with zero amplitude? Which is compatible with zero amplitude. This certainly comes from the choice of the prior. It's an effect of the choice of the prior.
Not from this particular example you mentioned, but in general, my experience is that most of the time, whenever it doesn't make sense, it's because of a poor or wrong choice of prior, or else if you've chosen a prior for convenience and you didn't really think about it. Yeah. So sometimes it's very tricky to actually understand what this choice of prior implies, especially if I say multi-level hierarchical models that have multiple levels of prior specification. So it is a very tricky issue. Yeah.
Especially also if you have something of which you know it must be either zero or positive, you will be, since you have a hard boundary at zero, your Monte Carlo Markov chain will kind of be reflected away from zero and
prefer to keep it possible.
That shouldn't be the case. That might be, that shouldn't be the case. It's not public, it shouldn't be the case. Mm-hmm. If you really have access not limit, you should purport it as such. But I'm not aware of this particular example, so I don't comment on this particular one.
So you are when you say fragments of plastic, you always mention the maximum lateral estimator. So in general, this is, I mean, we know that in many cases it has problems, it's not compliant, and so on. So in this sense, there are many proposed
more maximum. Of course. I'm using maximum lateral estimator as an example. Everyone is familiar with. By all means, I don't want to make a big bag of everything and put everything together, a big bag of maximum. There are much more sophisticated things around. But I think the overall conceptual picture is that I'm trying to motivate an approach by which we step away from likelihood-based methods, let's say, more generally, and try to look at this in a more generalized way. There is prior information that has to be put into the game. Sometimes it's relevant, sometimes it's difficult to specify, especially when you don't have much of an idea where to start from. It can be tricky, and it has to be about it. Great care as much for you. So prior must be proper, normalizable, that is. You say, oh, let me just, you're tempted to say, but looking at this too, you're tempted to say, well, let me just take this to be uniform and constant for theta, then the posterior is identical to the likelihood up to a normalization constant, so why should I bother? But of course, a constant prior is non-normalizable. It has to be cut off at some minimum and maximum value. And in general, it is not a good idea to have a critical uniform so-called prior for reasons I'm going to show you in a second.
So the rate of convergence to the likelihood, right, would be different. But I mean, of course, it depends on your choice of prior. If you choose something close to the likelihood, then you converge faster. But
You might not want to converge to the likelihood, as I said. Very Mankiewicz bias in a strong example. Okay, let me just give you this example just quickly here. Mankiewicz bias is what has been known for many years by astronomers, the fact that there are many, many more faint sources in the sky than there are bright sources. And so when you observe, because our surveys are flux limited, when you observe a given flux of a source, chances are that this is a fainter source that's been upscattered due to noise rather than a brighter source that's been downscattered, simply because the distribution of sources is steeply decreasing with flux, okay? So here's a case in point where we have very relevant prior information, the fact that there are many more faint sources out there than bright sources, and if you just ignore it, you're gonna get a bias, Mankiewicz bias. So we can just correct this by saying, well, we have a prior distribution of flux, which is actually informed by all we know about astronomy. I'm not suggesting for a second that priors should come out of nowhere. They should come out of scientific beliefs. So let's say this is gonna be a steeply decreasing function between some minimum and perhaps some maximum here, a cutoff. That makes it perfectly nice. So here is our prior distribution. And then, give you an example, I'll show you some numbers. Just to make this concrete. So then, and then we have a likelihood, which is a Poisson likelihood, if you are, say, a photon limited in the sky. And so we can then compute the posterior distribution in this prior. So the posterior for the flux, given that we've observed n photons in the sky, where n could be large or small, is going to be given by our prior. Let's say for definiteness that this is proportional to f to the minus 5 over 2, which is not far away from some categories of sources. And so then the posterior distribution is going to be given by also putting a constant C that converts fluxes to number counts of photons just to get this number here dimensionless. So it's going to be given by Poisson proportional to a Poisson distribution, but now with this term here, which drops and raises at low f, for f go to zero, right? So this is the Poisson term that dominates for large f, but then you have the prior that dominates for small f. And so if you plot this as a function of f, right? So if you pick a large n, okay, if you take n much bigger than one, so if you have lots of photons, then this term here becomes totally negligible and you're dominated by this. And you get a likelihood function that looks
like a very sharp likely function here for n large, let's say. I don't know. So that's n large. But if n is small, then the likelihood function peaks, for example, here. It's likelihood, but the posterior distribution would generally peak much lower because of this. It's a posterior. Because of the prior effect, I'm just highlighting in color. So what I'm trying to say is that you do not necessarily want to be at the top of the likelihood function whenever you know that there are things like distribution of sources in the sky that will bias this number high. And so if you do it properly, you don't need to account for Malpass bias. It's already in here in the posterior distribution because it's in the prior. So that's an example. Okay, but let me move on to discuss a couple more things in this context. Then I want to talk about Mesomorphic comparison because that's relevant to discovery. And we've been talking a lot about discovery claims for that matter.
I would like to say that just one comment, that
sure.
The diffuse prior in a parameter may be quite not diffuse if you just exactly. Change the parameter.
Exactly.
And there, for example, in the Malquist and so on, it's the number of photons. It's always related because the physical things are the number of photons that you get. But for example, in a theory of SUSE or something,
exactly.
You choose
exactly.
The scale or the logarithm of the scale. If you take something flat in the logarithm, the scale is completely.
Exactly.
So this is the point when you don't have information, you don't even know.
Exactly. I'm going to address this in 5 minutes.
But there are lots of papers that do that, including many of Roberto's, and they show the two log and flat priors next to each other, and usually they get about the same answer now. So it doesn't seem to be that important.
Well, you're right, Dan. We are getting close to the point where we've got enough data to make those problems go away, but it's a structural problem because we are in that regime for the CMSSM, which is a very restricted model.
Sure.
But now, okay, we've done this model. Now let's do the next model. Let's do the a higher dimensional parameter space. We're doing the PMSSM, which has got 24 free parameters. We have the same problem again. So it's a moving target.
Okay.
So as I agree with you. We can solve this with more data, but I agree with Pascal as well. It's a moving target. We always have this problem. So what do we do about it?
Right.
Okay. Let me give you a tentative answer in 3 minutes. Okay. But I just want to introduce the problem to everybody so we all know what we're talking about. So there are various problems with flat priors and high dimensions. I probably don't want to go there, although we can talk about it later. I just want to put out a cautionary note. Don't take this thing here to be flat. By flat, I mean uniform, or just put it to a constant, acritically. You have to be careful, because especially in high D, the curse of dimensionality will mean that your prior in high number of dimension becomes highly informative without even noticing it. Why do I say that? I just have to give you this one. Before I give you the SUSE example, I'll just give you this one example of what I mean. It's a simple fact. The sample uniformly. A sample, a vector theta uniformly from distribution which is flat between 0 and 1, so just a flat distribution within the dimension now. What happens is the mean of the radius in parameter space, the mean of the absolute value of theta, is actually root of d over 3. And the variance of this is constant. What that means is that as d increases, so here is the maximum value. The maximum value is d.
This
is the dimension of the parameter space, the number of dimensions.
Thank you.
Okay. So we're talking about sampling in high dimensions, which is always the case when you move to more complicated models. So what happens is here, so that's the location. If you're looking at the radius of where my samples are, as d increases, what happens is that all of my samples are on the surface of the hypersphere defined by this value here with constant variance. So the maximum value of my parameter space is out here, that's the max. I'm never going to see it because as d increases, all of my samples are in this cube here of constant variance. So all of my samples that are drawn uniform in each one of the dimensions, in high dimensions, that lie on the surface of the hypersphere. What's worse, as you know, the surface of the bottom of the hypersphere
by the volume of the hypercube goes to zero very quickly. So all of your samples on the surface of the sphere, you don't notice it because whenever you do 2D projections, they are all over the place. But in high dimensions, they're all very highly localized, and there is, you know, the vast majority of your volume never gets sampled. So random scans are a good idea. What do we do then to make things better and to explore this quantum space in a better fashion? Here's the sketch of this energy physics using example where, which is what something myself might already be working on for many years now. The idea that we start from some gut state theory, for example, some SUSY model, which is some parameters theta, and then we want to predict observables, and we can do so using running down in relation to the equations, which that's the key, they are highly non-linearly coupled with the observables. So we get here, you know, for a specific choice of parameter space values, I get a number of predictions for my collider, observables, cosmology, relativistic, let's say, direct and indirect detection quantities. And then I want to define a likely function here. My observables is a function of theta, even the data that are actually observed. And I want to use this to go back and learn something about parameter theory and eventually about the various models themselves. The problem is that, as well as Gratel was correctly pointing out, I have to specify P of theta, and very little is known about P of theta, but it's more if I make a nonlinear transformation of the input variables and get a different value of the prior. So what does it mean to have a diffuse prior? What does it mean to have a non-informative prior at this scale? Or what does it mean to have a naturalness prior if you want to? Naturalness. If you want to include the fact that you think the certain regions of parameter space are less fine-tuned than others, you can certainly do that by including the prior if you want to, but that's a theoretical assumption, it's not data driven. So what we have been doing, we have been playing this game using Bayesian technology. And the beauty of this, and that's my rubber stamp. The beauty of this is that, in a sense, you don't need to make a decision. But what we do need to do is to be aware of the issues. Here is a couple of examples of this, and what I suggest I should do about it. So, let me start from the end. That's the state of the art as far as the constraint of the system. A highly constrained version of SUSY, where we are making some pretty strong universality assumptions, such as gut scale, running down, compared with all the available observations, including LHC, direct and direct detection, not indirect, but direct detection, and down. What you're doing, so let's say, as a SUSY model, it's a four parameters model, so it's fairly constrained. But actually, this scan in order to take into account various other complications to do with observables and our residual uncertainty in standard model physics, it's actually a 17-dimensional scan. It's fairly high dimensional. What you see here in terms of the results is that we run this exercise for two different choices of prior, in this case for the genome mass and the scalar mass, one where the prior
one question before you continue. Yeah. It's normally said that it's 4.5 parameters because of the sign of mu. Can you work on the probability of what is more probable for the sign of mu?
This one's got sign mu fixed to be positive, but you could do positive and negative sign mu and then compare using Bayesian model comparison, which is a topic I hope to get to in the last 15 minutes. Because it's highly interesting and it's exactly one of the points. But this is
one of the marginalized over the other two parameters?
Can we marginalize over 15 parameters? Okay, because there's two parameters in the same set, but then you've got top mass and from top, you've got, you know, the strength of the all sorts of other things. You know, astrophysical uncertainties, the orbital lifetime distribution, everything is in this 17-dimensional parameter space.
All integrated. Tangent beta and MA are being marginalized.
That's right. In these two plots, they are marginalizing in the integrated away, and you can see that, first of all, marginalized means integrated away. So the difference between these two plots, first of all, is that this one here has got uniform priors in this variable here between, so the genome mass between 0 and 40 meter, and this one is 0 and 40 as well. That's the boundary of our prior scan. And the empty contours are the state, well, the state of the art a couple of years ago before the latest HC data, and now you can see that the new HC unit comes in, cuts away certain regions, for example, the H4 region here, that is a lot of paper, and then pushes everything up to higher masses. That's the colored regions. So the flat prior, the best fit however is found down here, very far away from what the flat prior says the posterior probability mass should be. If we do the scan with a log prior, that's to say a prior that's flattening the log of these two variables, reflecting the fact that we know what the scale of those masses might be, then we used to see a little bit, well, quite a bit of probability up here, but you can see that loss of probability gets concentrated down here, just above the LHC limit, where the actual best fit is also found.
Did the LHC limit affect your prior, or not?
Well, then she certainly got cut away as part of the space that was allowed under prior. That's what she wanted.
The log prior, so it piles up just above.
It piles up just above here because, you know, under the log prior, all of your volume is piled up against the log masses.
The LHC data isn't the prior, though, it's in the data.
It's in the data, that's right. The prior is just a choice for where I am up here in this parameter space. The difference with this is here it's actually a profile likely plot. So this is essentially maximizing the value of the likely in the given dimensions. You can see it kind of starts to agree, especially this island down here. Is seen by both the Bayesian posterior and the profile likely scan, although the profile likely is much more sharply peaking around the best fit. So we are converging to a status where actually there is still substantial difference in the scientific conclusions of those scans, even for the most constrained models such as this, which is all but a quad model, but we're starting to see a consistent picture once we include all of these constraints that we are
So this is frequentist on the right.
That's right. And the point I'm making is that we can use this Bayesian, highly developed Bayesian technology with highly sophisticated scans to drive around this highly dimensional parameter space, not only to derive posterior distributions in the Bayesian sense, but equally to derive robust, statistically converged profile likely scans, which will get a maximum likely approach, which would be very hard to do in high dimensions, but we can pull it out of the Bayesian. So we can compare, and then we can decide, based on this information, what is the scientific conclusions of the scan. It's up to you. I'm telling you that what I've done is the Bayesian view. That's the profile likely view, up to you what you want to make of it. In the future, we have a technology that to...
I think there's a question.
How about a naturalness prior where you penalize larger masses?
I don't have the plot here, but that's something that Bruce, for example, has worked a lot on. What happens is, similarly to this, you get a shift of probability down to Bayesian sense down to the masses, but most of it is actually driven by the prior itself, not by the likelihood. And so it's basically assumption, it's theoretically motivated, but it's your assumptions value you fit more than data. You'd like to be in an asymptotic regime where you don't need those assumptions a la Laplace, if you like.
The Higgs mass is fixed to 125.
The Higgs constraint is applied. Okay. Yes. It's not fixed, you actually don't get 125 yet. The best fixture is 123.
Well, but I mean, that's good.
But yeah, it is included. Yeah. That's most of what drives this cutting away of that part here. It's given mostly by the Higgs.
But this result is surprising, no? Because the bounds coded by LHC are around the TV for all supersymmetric particles, no? So you are getting much lower bounds.
That depends on specific search. You have to look at what the spectrum looks like in all these plots.
So that's the dashed yellow line.
Yeah, basically it's this. It's this one here, which goes down for the genome mass. It goes down to 95%. It's about 800 on TV in this plot.
So, sorry, one more question. This is all very interesting. The region that isn't highly favored by the Bayesian analysis. But just near the LHC line, is there an intuitive reason for why the Bayesian analysis doesn't like that? So maybe M0 of 1.5 and M1/2 of 500 or something.
That's because under the prior, all of your prior mass is piled up high because you've got a flat prior going from 0 to 40.
Okay, so use the log prior.
The purpose of the analysis is to show that the posterior results are not yet robust to the choice.
That's not what I mean. I mean, like, point at 1.5 TeV in 0 and half a TeV in 1/2.
Right.
So why is that so disfavored by either of the Bayesian analyses?
But you say 1.5 and 1.5 here?
No. 1.5 M0 and 0.5 M1 there. Why is that so disfavored?
That's a combination of constraints, not just the LHC bound, it's everything else as well. And
that matter, I think.
You think it's a red density?
Yeah, red density constraint.
Down here.
The part.
But I'm happy that you don't have the red density.
Yes, yes.
So
there is a special mechanism. So all the, basically the mass, or the back of the posterior, which is in that region there, okay, is driving by this omega h squared, which is the pseudoscalar mass. So you need this special condition for the pseudoscalar mass.
In MA is built in M0, so I can't move
it
on.
Yeah, times the mass of the neutralium is equal to the mass of the pseudoscalar. So you need a special region where you can achieve
that.
Good, I'm fine now, I'm fine now.
Sorry, I have a dumb confusion. It kind of looks like M1 half is bounded above on these plots, but it shouldn't be, right? You haven't found anything.
Well, it is in a sense simply because it gets increasingly, in this direction, as you increase M1 half, it gets increasingly. So you've got a wedge, which is given by the fact that below this wedge, the neutralium is not the LSP, the style of the LSP. So as you go up in this direction, it gets increasingly difficult to both satisfy a electrical density constraint and to get the neutralium to be the LSP. So, that is bound
here, essentially. I'm sorry, you're putting in that dark matter would come from this?
Yeah.
You get too
which
much dark matter
assumption.
If you go too far up.
Okay, but this is a big assumption.
No, it's not so big because we don't want to overexpose the
universe. No, exactly. You can relax it in one direction, you can make it just an upper bound, but it wouldn't get better because you're overproducing that.
Make the gravity know the LSP and then you don't have a problem. Right.
Well, but that's not the constraint. That's not the constraint. That's
just an assumption. So, how much time do we have left?
Maybe we can keep this discussion on statistics because then tomorrow there's Roberto Ruiz.
That's right.
I'm going
to talk about this in great detail. So,
good.
Hold you on the fire. Yeah. Now, in the last 5 minutes, I do want to talk briefly about another important point. So, one thing I said now is about Bayesian inference for parameters, and there are issues here as well. Perhaps the most interesting part of the talk is always the one that gets cut off again. She's model comparison. Okay, how do we make discoveries? And what is the difference between Bayesian approach and the classical or hypothesis? Anyone probably hypothesis testing. In the interest of time, I'd like to keep this at the sketch level. Okay, let's see. On selection. The basic approach to model selection is very different from the p-value approach that you're familiar with. The idea is that when we have different models on the table, we want to compare the relative fit quality by looking at the posterior odds, which are the ratio of the evidences, so those numbers here are just the normalizing constants in Bayes' theorem times the ratio of the prior. Say half and half, we can start off with two models that I believe are very probable. This ratio here is called the Bayes factor. And it gives you the updating of the odds from the prior odds, half and half, to the posterior odds after you've seen the data. The interest of this quantity is that, being as is, the integral on all quantum space of your theory of the prior, it encompasses automatically the idea that simpler theories should be preferred, and not Occam's razor factor. Namely, the idea that if you are in data space now, and here I'm plotting the evidence as a function of potential data, you have a model which is very complex. Many free parameters that can be adjusted in many ways, many knobs turn. It doesn't predict anything very much. It's very diffuse. Pretty much any data you observe are equally likely in that model. And then you have a second model, which is much more predictive, perhaps because it's got fewer free parameters, so it makes very specific predictions. So it's a simpler model. And now you go out and make an observation, and you observe this data here, which agree with both models, but agree in particular with the simpler model. Well, we all know that we would all prefer the simpler model. The Popperian view of physics that we can only science of only falsifying models by disproving them is simply wrong. We all know that models that make correct predictions should get boosted, but the degree of belief in these models should get boosted. That's what this quantity here does for you. In fact, if you compute it, it's one here called the Bayes factor, B01, updating probabilities for the models. If you compute it for a simple case, of the last thing first. If you're computing for a simple case where, let's say you have two models which are nested into each other, so got a baseline model, background only, no signal, and the more complicated model which has got a signal on top, which you want to try to estimate and see whether it's real. So you have a prior for the strength of that signal, you have theta, and zero means there's no signal, so the super model is at zero. You measure the mean parameter, some uncertainty, which is accepted by the theta hat. And the distance between zero and the measurement value, which we call the lambda, just theta hat over delta theta, the width of the Lyapunov function. So it's a number of sigma significance. Okay? Lambda is how many sigma, at how many sigma I have detected my signal. Okay? Now we want to go through this exercise of comparing the model where I have no signal, that's model zero, with the model where I do have a signal, model one. It's a simple calculation. If you do it, we find that the log of the base factor between two models is given by this expression, the log of the width of the prior, delta theta, divided by the width of the likelihood, minus lambda squared over 2. What that means is that here we have, remember, because that's for zero odds, the positive value of this quantity means simpler model is favored, the negative value means the more complicated model is favored. So you can see here that this quantity here always favors the more complicated model. Obviously, if I detected something at high sigma, then I should favor it. But then I have a quantity here, the Occam's razor factor, which is always bigger than zero, in the regime where the prior is more broad than the posterior or the likelihood. Because if that's not the case, then the posterior is similar to the prior, you haven't learned anything, so you're going to be in there. So the thing here is the Occam's factor that penalizes the more complicated model for being more complicated. And as long as your prior is meaningful, with all the caveats we discussed, this automatically encompasses the natural, sort of the naturalness of that being. That's my last slide, just to drive this point.
You don't mean naturalness in the particle physics sense?
No, I mean naturalness as in, more better than naturalness, but in simplicity. That's what I mean.
Some sort of Occam's razor, like.
That's right. So here is how to interpret those kind of things. So this here is one, it's more a comparison based on framework, talking number of sigma significance versus information gain. That's to say, how many times in log 10 units the prior is more sharply peaked than the prior is more broad than the likelihood. How much information you gain in going from the prior to the posterior, express this in bits if you like. And these regions here show where the different models are preferred in the Bayesian sense. Down here, you got increasing preference for the simpler model, because you've learned a lot about, you've cut away a lot of the parameter space that was available under the prior, but you haven't yet gotten much evidence for the extra parameter. So you should stick with the simpler model. Up here, the extra parameter is applied. Of course, if you measure something at 4 or 5 sigma, then yes, you do need the extra parameter, but you notice that this here is much more conservative. You know, in other words, a 4 sigma result in classical hypothesis testing is perhaps evaluates posterior odds of a little over 150 to 1 in Bayesian sense. So the classical idea of p-values as representing probabilities of hypothesis, which we all know is wrong, but we sort of are compelled to interpret them this way, is very much overthrown in terms of actually looking at posterior probabilities of hypothesis. So if you apply this framework in the context, for example, of deciding what the spectral index for the Cauchy microtonal spectrum is, different from one, which is the simplest state of mind you can write down, had a prior motivated by inflationary conservation. That's where WMAP1 was putting the model comparison between a scale by model with no spectral index, no change of the fluctuations in scale, and versus a model where you do have evidence for a change of fluctuations. So it was a limit where you couldn't be inside. WMAP3 came along, better data, so we started gathering evidence for two. Non-zero spectral index, not different from one mean. And from this point, want to make a Bayesian prediction, which I just know, that the 90% probability client would find the result up here, accounting for models, uncertainty, accounting for the uncertainty, residual uncertainty in the models, and client indeed is up here. So you can see that marching forward on information content for fixed prior, we're gathering more and more information. As we do so, our model gets preferred higher and higher odds in this trajectory here. And so this framework, answer to your question, could be applied, to, in, for example, in deciding between Susie models. However, it's very hard thing to do because, different from this case, it's very hard to put a meaningful prior on these theories, and all the caveats that we discussed apply even more strongly in the case of model comparison than they apply in the case of parameter inference. What can I say? I'll probably stop here, actually, because there's lots more to say. But I think the only my final summary is the following: that there are lots of tools here that we've been developing in a number of contexts and been deploying in the background researches. It's becoming increasingly clear that there's no clear-cut answer to all of these complicated scientific questions. We never will get at the edge of what the data are capable of telling us, and therefore we should be very careful in analyzing those data using all available tools and making sure we've got the full information in front of us before we make scientific conclusions in this not quite data-dominated regime that we're all working in at some level. Thank you very much.
Can you give me an example of a situation where there were papers in the literature that used Bayesian techniques, they estimated to address a question, got one answer, and then people using frequentist techniques got a markedly different answer? And which one? I mean, are there examples that go both ways? And can you give me examples?
Yeah, there are several examples. One example that springs to mind is when we started doing these scans many years ago, that we plotted in 2000. Scan. That's the plot we can upgrade in 2006. Okay, that's the first blob that Fabric used in the smaller region to solve. So at this point, other people looking at maximum likelihood methods, they were consistently claiming that essentially the probability of finding actually the probability was very sharply peaked down here. And what happened, so very low masses and Susie scale at the order of a few GV was around the corner to be discovered by the LHC.
Is that because of G minus 2?
Partially because of G minus 2, but also because, in general, as you saw in the other plots, profile likely contours give much tighter answer around the best fit for just for the definition of what is maximum likely profile is. And so we came up with this plot and said, well, actually, this is the best we can say given this Bayesian scan. It seems that this probability mass is very diffuse. We can understand this based on the physics, etc. And it's simply not constraining enough. We cannot really tell. So what happened is, as new data came in and the LHC started accumulating data, all the best fits that have been claimed by a very low mass is started moving upwards, and upwards. Until now, effectively, the other groups like these answers have fairly converged to our own. So that's an example where things. You know, typically what happens is if you do things in a more careful way, you get large uncertainties, so you're less sure.
But this isn't really an example of what I asked for because we don't know that either of these are right, right? This stuff hasn't been
like that things stuff hasn't been settled, but now the answers have converged.
No, we don't know that this model has anything to do with reality. So I'm asking for an example where in the end we knew one of the predictions made by Bayesian or frequentist groups was correct.
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, I think for example, let's look at the predictions specifically, but for example, the CMB community has moved very heavily towards Bayesian techniques the last 10, 15 years, and they totally dominate the field now. There are also technical reasons why that's been easier than in this kind of business. But
did frequentists make incorrect predictions about CMB data?
I think about predictions, but it's difficult to say because at the moment where Bayesian techniques took off, that's where the data also increasingly became difficult to analyze, and it wasn't possible to use these old grid scanning techniques anymore. So certain people went out of business or moved on to do it that Bayesian way because it was no longer feasible to do these kind of things without the higher efficiency that's allowed by these techniques. So I don't have a clear-cut example of that, but I think it's very much a case of things being done with off-the-shelf standard textbook methods until you can't anymore, and then you have to move to something more complicated, and this is a possible way of doing so. With more powerful tools that fit the bill for the current more complicated data sets that we didn't even need for, frankly, or possibly to apply 20 years ago.
Please?
Yes, just a short comment. In the Planck parameter paper, we outline very briefly a cross-check of the parameter fit that we've done with a frequentist approach with profile likelihood. And it's perfectly in agreement with the other one.
That's right, but there's a technical reason for that, is because the likelihood of some is fairly Gaussian and almost linear parameters,
yeah,
which is very not the case here.
Except for the neutrino mass limit.
Which is a limit, and so here we go. It's a perfect example. Thank you for bringing this up, because it's a perfect example where we are in the regime where we haven't measured that parameter well at all, we haven't measured it, and so different estimates will diverge. And then so the question remains, which one should we trust? And what does it mean?
No, they do agree.
The
neutrino mass limit that we get with
but the question remains, right? Because if you need this plan using, for example, the Bayesian model comparison approach, then you would say, well, actually, neutrino mass is not needed. There's also a regime where you haven't measured the functions well enough to be able to actually converge on the natural mass.
What is the definition of marginalized?
Yeah, sorry. That's a good
question. Why is that funny?
You do like that.
That's good.
So whenever you have this high-dimensional parameter space, you have to find a way of eliminating the extra parameters that you're not interested in plotting. So you start from this quantity here, which is the joint probability for all the parameters, and then you want to eliminate theta, let's say. You can say you just integrate the map like this. So you integrate the posterior probability over the parameters you're not interested. So that's different from the profile likelihood of the marginal posterior that the Bayesian plot has showed. The profile likelihood, the difference is that you take the likelihood function, not the posterior. Then the likelihood function, and say the likelihood function for theta is take the likelihood function for theta and psi, and then maximize it over psi. That's the profile. So here you solve a hard maximization problem in all the dimensions. Then you don't need to, because you just integrate, and integrals are for free when you have a maximization problem.
Measures is flat in theta?
This one?
In psi?
Which one? This one? That's a posterior, so posterior is the likelihood times the prior. There is a prior in here, but then we use this prior. It doesn't look to be prior. It can be, but it doesn't.
Okay, great. Well, you can all continue to try the problem. Thank you.